The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hello. In 1846, the critic Belinsky said, "There is, quote, seemingly nothing easier, but in fact, nothing harder than to write about Russian literature." End quote. Belinsky had early greats like Pushkin and Gogol to talk about, but some of Russia's greatest literature was yet to come. Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Turgenev, Chekhov, Pasternak, these became household names in Russia and beyond. At the start of the 20th century, as Russian literature became more widely available in English, a kind of Russian craze set in among English-speaking writers and intellectuals. H.G. Wells and Henry James were fans, even fanatics. And Virginia Woolf, 20 years after reading War and Peace at the age of 26, said that she read it one summer while lying in bed, enthralled, and that she had called Tolstoy the greatest of novelists ever since. In 1914, 34 British intellectuals signed a statement in the London Times thanking Russian writers for their contributions to the world. Quote, "Beneath all the strangeness, there was a deep sense of having discovered a new home, of meeting our unknown kindred, of finding expressed great burdens of thought which had lain unspoken." End quote. Even today, we talk about Russian literature, or sometimes just the Russians, as in, "I've been reading the Russians," as if Russian novels and sometimes short stories and poetry are a thing apart, a special something exemplifying certain qualities and undeniably great. Genius, we say, unrivaled, unsurpassed, culturally significant, great achievements on a level with Bach and Mozart or the Sistine Chapel. They have become an indestructible part of the furniture of our rooms, Wolfe said, as they belong for good to the furniture of our minds. End quote. But was it always so? Why did Russian literature take up this space in the nation of Russia and in the world beyond? Did these geniuses just emerge out of nowhere like UFOs? Were they created by their age, promoted by publishers and critics? And did any of those people have an agenda? Was Russian literature great because they wanted Russia to be great? Did an intellectual class will it into being? Or did they just get lucky? We'll talk with scholar Rolf Hellebust about his book, How Russian Literature Became Great, today on the History of Literature. Okay, hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the podcast. Here we go. I'm Jack Wilson, your host. Today we're going to explore Russian literature. It's hard to separate that from Russia today, which is so in the news, and we'll talk about that a bit with Rolf. Although, to be fair, this interview was recorded a few months ago, and this is not a show about current events, and we are traveling in time back to the 19th century, mostly, so enough said about that. Instead, let's talk about Virginia Woolf some more, or let's let her talk even better. Here she is on sadness in Russian literature. Quote, "The simplicity, the absence of effort, the assumption that in a world bursting with misery, the chief call upon us is to understand our fellow sufferers, and not with the mind, for it is easy with the mind, but with the heart. This is the cloud which broods above the whole of Russian literature, which lures us from our own parched brilliancy and scorched thoroughfares to expand in its shade, and of course, with disastrous results." End quote. Okay, what are these disastrous results? Well, she tells us, quote, "We become awkward and self-conscious, denying our own qualities. We write with an affectation of goodness and simplicity, which is nauseating in the extreme. But it is common suffering, rather than common happiness, effort, or desire that produces the sense of brotherhood. It is the deep sadness, as one scholar puts it, typical of the Russian people that creates their literature." End quote. Deep sadness. That's the unifying theme, isn't it? That's what ties it all together. We read the Russians for the deep sadness. That's what they capture. Interesting theory, but there's more than just sadness. Wolf was aware of that as well. She has praise for Chekhov and Dostoevsky. I probably have quoted this passage before, but let's do it again. Here's Wolf on Dostoevsky. It's so good. The novels of Dostoevsky are seething whirlpools, gyrating sandstorms, waterspouts which hiss and boil and suck us in. They are composed purely and wholly of the stuff of the soul. Against our wills, we are drawn in, whirled round, blinded, suffocated, and at the same time filled with a giddy rapture. Out of Shakespeare, there is no more exciting reading. We open the door and find ourselves in a room full of Russian generals, the tutors of Russian generals, their stepdaughters and cousins, and crowds of miscellaneous people who are all talking at the tops of their voices about their most private affairs. But where are we? Surely it is the part of a novelist to inform us whether we are in a hotel, a flat, or hired lodging. Nobody thinks of explaining. We are souls, tortured, unhappy souls, whose only business it is to talk, to reveal, to confess, to draw up at whatever rending of flesh and nerve those crabbed sins which crawl on the sand at the bottom of us. End quote. Soul is a big word for Wolf. When we read Chekhov, she says, we find ourselves saying that word again and again and again. These stories were strange to her. She was surprised by what they discussed and what they didn't, what they emphatically discussed, overflowing without constraints. In Chekhov and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, they approached storytelling and the project of literature differently from how the English were approaching those things. Tolstoy was slightly different. His concern was not just the soul, but life itself. Life dominates Tolstoy as the soul dominated Dostoevsky, Wolf said. Quote, there is always at the center of all the brilliant and fleshing petals of the flower, this scorpion. Why live? End quote. It was hard to get used to it, but it felt like greatness to her. Where did that greatness come from? Was it a real thing? Was it propaganda promoted by the government? Or did it occur in spite of it? Did the marketplace generate this greatness? How the devil did it happen? Rolf Hellebust joins us after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining me now is Rolf Hellebust, who is a UK-based scholar currently working with the Brilliant Club University Access Charity. He's also senior editor of the journal Canadian Slavonic Papers. He's here today to discuss his new book, How Russian Literature Became Great. Rolf Hellebust, welcome to the History of Literature.
Hello, Jack. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
So when did your interest in Russian literature begin?
Oh, well, that was a while ago. I suppose I started reading Russian literature already in high school. Mm-hmm. This is back in Toronto. I'm Canadian originally. Maybe Turgenev's Fathers and Sons or Solzhenitsyn's Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich would be my first ones, though I can't quite remember. My father always encouraged me to read far beyond literature written in English. So if he's listening to this, I'd like to say thank you very much for encouraging me.
Right.
So that's how I got started.
Right. And it kind of gave you a vocation. When did you decide to make Russian literature the focus of your scholarship?
Well, it certainly wasn't a vocation from the get-go. I mean, I'm not even sure I know what I want to be when I grow up now, but I certainly didn't when I was starting off as an undergraduate at the University of Toronto. I actually started off taking astrophysics, something totally different. And halfway through the program, for reasons that I'll never fully explain to myself, I decided to switch to comparative literature. And Russian was one of the focuses, and continued narrowing the focus with the MA and the PhD on Russian topics. And as I said, I was interested in a lot of different national literatures. I had a practical reason for doing Russian, to read the Soviet astronomy and physics journals when I was doing that stuff. But, you know, no personal preference. So the actual genesis of the book that I just published really dates back to these times. It dates back to me asking these most fundamental questions about, you know, what is this phenomenon of Russian literature? Why am I studying it as opposed to any other national literature? You know, what are the principles of its celestial mechanics? How does it work? How does the national culture present its literature as something special, something worthy of my attention in comparison to all the others?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned celestial mechanics. I actually, when you mentioned astrophysics and Russian literature, I did feel like there is a bit of a connection there, some harmony. I don't know if that's infinite darkness or what it is, but it seems like you are kind of in the same mental space in some ways.
Well, I don't know. You know, there is far less infinite darkness than sometimes appears to readers from the West, especially people who are fans of Dostoevsky, who has some funny passages as well. But certainly the focus on the big cosmic question is something that is fascinating. And, you know, that sort of led me to ask some big cosmic questions in sort of a meta way, not about Dostoevsky or any specific individual Russian writer, but about the whole phenomenon of Russian literature, how it's been seen as special in the culture, and how it's been representative as a sort of a cultural meta-narrative by critics and literary historians.
Okay, so before we turn to how Russian literature became great, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your earlier book, Flesh to Metal, Soviet Literature and the Alchemy of Revolution, and what you were able to explore in that book.
Well, that one, at least on the surface, it's a different century, 20th rather than 19th, which is my main focus, the classical 19th century Russian literature. And this was mainly on Soviet literature and how it expressed the whole, again, mythic cultural narrative of revolutionary change, basically the metaphor that from human beings, you know, it's not just the revolution will change our economy or our politics or whatever. It will change our very essence as human beings. And the image that you often see in socialist, realist Soviet literature is people being compared to metal. Probably the most familiar example would be the leader Stalin himself. He was originally called Djugashvili, not Russian, but Georgian. And he took this name, Man of Steel, as it were, Stalin, from the Russian word Stal. So this whole idea that we will become like steel, purely using poetic language to describe a sort of radical transformation of humanity that really couldn't be accessed any other way. And that, I suppose, on an underlying level, there's a similarity with the current book, and that is that you have a belief in the Russian culture that evolutionary change isn't going to work so well, so it has to be revolutionary change of whatever, you know, nature, political, spiritual, whatever. And also this focus on literature as the place where you invoke the radical change that you want to see. And so this radical change, this sudden revolution in the human spirit, is something that we can only approach using these indirect tools of poetic language rather than, you know, the ostensibly rational language of intellectual discourse. And here it involves a lot of secularized religious patterns of thought, which you see me touch on in the book again and again. And by the way, all of this is relevant for understanding the ideological landscape of contemporary Russia, including the current geopolitical situation.
Right. Okay. So let's save that for a little bit later, but let's go back to the 19th century. I find it a little more intuitive to me how things, the 20th century changes that they were aiming for. But what was going on in the 19th century and what kind of change was brewing there?
Well, no change that people could see. You know, Russia, to go back a bit before then, had gone through a very long Middle Ages, as it were, without any renaissance on the model of Western Europe. And they only came out of it around the time of Peter the Great, who is famous for westernizing Russia and opening it up to all sorts of influences, including cultural and literary influences. And this was the beginning of the 18th century. And then gradually, by the beginning of the 19th century, Russia was having this sense that we are writing Western style literature, and it is a powerful force. Romanticism was a very influential movement at the time, and that plays a major role in my book. And that included the idea that poets and writers are really people we should look for to express national identity and even the destiny of the nation. So there was a sense of an exalted role for the writer, but also an oppositional role, because the powers that be, it was of course an autocratic Tsarist regime that wished to freeze any sort of possible change. So the famous writers that we know from 19th century Russia, as a rule, tended to have some sort of oppositional stance to the Tsarist regime. And some of the goals, of course, they might want to see for radical change was getting rid of the institution of serfdom, freeing the peasants, even overthrowing the monarchy. Or for more conservative people, like, say, Dostoevsky in his late career, it was a more inner spiritual change, going back to the basics of Russian Orthodoxy, which made all these writers, of course, dangerous, whether they were right-wing or left-wing, for the regime that just basically wanted to keep the status quo.
Right. Now, I want to kind of understand, we think of the heavyweights in 19th century Russian literature, and I guess from Pushkin through Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Chekhov and so on. But are you talking about readers who are following the lead of some of these great giants of literature? Or are you talking about the sort of literary culture of bookstores and small presses and people who are reading and writing literary magazines and journals, and maybe people who are sitting at home with, you know, poetry in their desk drawer and that kind of thing? Are we just talking about what they're learning from a handful of individuals, or is this kind of literary culture in general?
I suppose a bit of both. The main thing is that the mission that people saw the poets and novelists as having, it's not something you can reduce to some sort of gradual cultural change in, you know, intellectual fashions or what have you. It was this large-scale revolutionary change, something that in the book I refer to it as the redemptive mission, which might raise some hackles. It's not to say that all of these writers were writing from a religious perspective, but very much it was, again, a secularized sort of religious mentality in that, as I say in the introductory chapter, a nation saved by the word, this religious sense of the word, that somehow literature would do this. And it wasn't just, by the way, following the great writers from Pushkin onwards. It was really following the great critics, because in no other nation and no other century, basically, did literary critics have the same influence. So they sort of helped interpret the works, write what the writers themselves, because of the censorship or whatever, couldn't write, and lead the readers in the right direction. And they had an immense influence. And of course, we're only talking about still a small percentage of the whole Russian population. And most of the population in the 19th century was illiterate peasantry. We were talking about the Western-educated cultural elite in the two capital cities of Moscow and Petersburg, who were basically consuming and creating the whole literary culture. So it was a rather small but very active segment of society.
And we often think of great artists as trying to be universal and to say, this is what it means to be a human being living on the planet Earth. But it sounds like there's something you're finding that's more particularized than that and saying, this is who we are. This is what Russia is. And this is our identity. And maybe this is our destiny. Do I have that right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, on the one hand, you have people who read Turgenev or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky in particular in translation and really look for these writers for universal issues that would transcend any cultural, historical specificity, so that you don't have to know too much about 19th century Russian culture to get into the questions of good and evil and does God exist are dealt with in novels like The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. And on the other hand, you do see these writers, beginning with Pushkin, explicitly deal with the question of Russian identity, Russianness, national character, in a way that you don't in the West. So Dickens in the 19th century is a Western novelist. You don't see him writing, oh, what is London like? What is England like? What is the British national character? Can't imagine that whatsoever. Whereas people like Gogol will explicitly end his novel, Dead Souls, asking the question, where are you off to, Russia? Mm-hmm. He doesn't answer the question, by the way, but he does ask that. And so there is, besides the universal concerns of Russian literature, there is this specific national element, and that really does come back to the romantic influence, the idea that the poet is the creator of the nation.
I was going to ask if it also comes back in some sense to their particular position with respect to Europe and the West, and to a feeling that we're here too, and we're in this kind of special category of maybe arriving a little bit late, and maybe our literature is kind of just getting off the ground now, but there is something here that's, we're not just an appendage or a satellite. We have our own territory and our own way of doing things, and maybe our own geniuses as well.
Yeah, I have to compliment you on the really good and well-informed questions you're asking. It was precisely a number of factors that came together in the 19th century in Russia, and it did have to do indeed with the a sense of we are Europe, but maybe not Europe. Maybe we're catching up to Europe, or maybe we're better than Europe, the sort of combined superiority, inferiority complex that you really see down to the present day. The idea that we are a nation that has suffered, right? We are a martyr nation for the world. We saved the world when the Mongols came by. We saved Europe when Napoleon came by. And then, of course, that goes on with Hitler in World War II and so on and so forth. And basically, once we get on our feet again, and we will show the world what we are really capable of. For Russia, Western-style genres of romantic poetry and then later novels were something fairly new. They didn't have a long tradition going back into the 18th century with novels like in England, not to speak of Don Quixote in Spain. It was something new, was something different. And this also, this went together with the sense that the Russian language as a modern language, as a literary language, was still new and was evolving, where modern English, we think of it evolving in Shakespeare's time, he introducing all sorts of things. It was Pushkin in the 1820s, 1830s, who was seen as a great reformer of the Russian language, making it this powerful tool that could express anything we wanted to express. And of course, this is in the context of most of the Russian aristocrats speaking French as their first language. Mm-hmm. So, it was the Russian language and Russian literature seen as something new, as Russians feeling themselves to be outsiders to Europe, feeling that they had to something to contribute that had to be different, but maybe not worse.
Mm. There does seem to be this big movement. I was just talking to someone about the Czech manuscripts hoax and kind of the importance that they felt of, we need to have a Czech author. We need to have a Czech writer in order to kind of unify ourselves and give ourselves some pride and some national identity. And it does seem like, just given the geopolitical state at the time where borders are being redrawn and alliances are shifting, and there's maybe a feeling of, well, who are we exactly? And the one thing you can point to is language, and to feel good about yourself as a fellow speaker of that language. You are glad when a Pushkin comes along or a Tolstoy comes along, and you can think, well, we belong on the same stage as everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth bearing in mind that although a lot of these factors the Russians like to point out as being unique to them, this is all in Russia. When you always you look at it, and you'll always see that there's some sort of Western influence that is actually involved. And in this case, as I say, Romanticism, in particular German Romanticism. And if you understand the situation of Germany in the 19th century, they, of course, didn't have any unified political state until the latter part of the century. Language and culture was this amazingly important factor for them in expressing their nascent national identity, and the Russians definitely took that ball and ran with it. Although they were already a huge empire themselves, there's also the geographical question of where does Russia end and where do the other ethnic and political groups begin, which is, of course, also of relevance today. So the factor of a common language, a common literary heritage, was really important indeed.
Let's take a quick break and come back with more from Ralph Kalibas. Okay, we're back. So, Ralph, I can imagine someone reading the book's title, How Russian Literature Became Great, and kind of saying to themselves, well, wasn't it just because they were lucky to have a few genius writers in the right place at the right time? And isn't that what made the greatness? But what does this miss in your analysis?
Oh, I'd love to get a reaction like that from readers. The title is designed to be a bit provocative. The adjective there is a highly problematic adjective, especially in this day and age. And in general, of course, I'm not really focusing on some sort of objective confirmation of the absolute greatness of Russian literary culture, more on the phenomenon of greatness and of a national literary tradition, and what does it mean and how is it expressed? So there is a question that I refuse to answer in the book as to what extent, on the one hand, the genius writers were really statistically overrepresented in the 19th century in Russia, and on the other hand, to what extent were they merely the beneficiaries of a culture that demanded they appear? As you were saying in the previous question before the break, the stars were in the right location for people to want all of this stuff to appear, to confirm the national identity. And, you know, it wasn't just in Russia that this sort of thing happened. I could also mention the Ossian forgeries in Scotland, a classical romantic location, or the question that was for quite a while over the supposed Russian national epic, the Tale of Igor's Host, that many people thought was a forgery for a while because it was just too conveniently appearing in the Romantic era, exactly what we want, a national epic. Most scholars agree it probably is authentic nowadays, but certainly there was a demand for the Pushkins and so on to appear. And all these things we were talking about before made it the right time for it to happen, and especially the sense that Russian literature didn't exist before Pushkin, before, you know, the 1820s when he came on the scene, which isn't true at all. There are a lot of great works of Russian literature going back into the Middle Ages, but precisely because it was this romantic mindset, literature has to be a certain sort of thing. It has to reflect national identity. Church-bound literature isn't going to fit the bill. So the Russian critics said, we have no literature. We're waiting for it to arrive. The main Russian critic, a guy called Vissarion Belinsky, would write annual reviews of the state of Russian literature, and he would be writing, well, we are starting there, we're not quite there, next year, we're not quite there. And then, you know, finally after Pushkin's written enough, we really have the national literature. So he was sort of stage managing the whole thing into existence.
Right. It kind of reminds me in a way of some people I knew who would be of a certain ethnic background, and they would win prizes, and they would think, this is going to change things for the particular hyphen that I am. I don't want to name it, but it's sort of something hyphen American. And they'd sort of say, I'm going to be that person now. And no one has won the such and such prize before me. And recognizing that this was going to come with a kind of responsibility. And it seems like maybe these Russian novelists, as they were going, they would kind of give them some ambition and a sort of responsibility that would come with it to say, well, if I'm going to be, you know, writing a novel, Belinsky is going to be, I think you said his name was Belinsky, he's going to be writing this in his write-up, and I'm going to try to fulfill the things that he's calling for and try to fit myself into something that shows that I'm a worthy heir of whatever it is that has come before, and I'm going to lead the way toward the future.
Yes, and all of these writers were basically within one or two generations of one another, the really big names. It's not the whole of the 19th century. It's really just the central half century, beginning with Pushkin around 1820s and 30s, and ending with the big novels, final novels of people like Turgenev and Dostoevsky by the 1880s. And almost all of these names we've been mentioning had some sort of connection to this central cultural figure, this critic, Vissarion Belinsky. Tolstoy always stood a bit to the side and did his own thing. But certainly he was a major, major influence, a sort of impresario for the whole evolving national tradition. And though some people could withstand his influence and basically pointing in the right direction, a big example of somebody who couldn't was Gogol, whom I mentioned, who's famous for writing the novel Dead Souls. And he basically felt this need to please. He was trying to get all his influence from Pushkin, who came before him, and then didn't know what to do, at least he said, after Pushkin died. And Belinsky was trying to mold him into a certain type of a progressive left-wing writer, which was not really congenial to Gogol's own temperament. And in short, he killed himself trying to be the great prophet for Russian literature that Belinsky was demanding. He had fits of religious mania, and he burnt on several occasions the continuation to Dead Souls, his masterpiece, which he wanted to make into a national epic along the lines of Dante's Divine Comedy, and just couldn't do that because that really wasn't the nature of his talent. So the critics had this influence that it's very difficult for us to understand the role that they played in society those days. They have to be kept in mind. And the book itself is as much about the critics and the literary historians. I know the podcast is history of literature, so it's relevant for this. You know, when I ask the question, where is the literary tradition? What is this thing called a literary tradition? I'm not looking so much at evidence within the individual masterpieces that are ranked up in the canon. I'm looking at the statements from critics, and in more particular from literary historians summing things up by the end of the 19th century, who sort of make the literary tradition into its own story, its own text, which is really centering on the biographies of the writers that every Russian school child knows, the highs and the lows and the dramatic ends of people like Pushkin.
Was there a reason why it was focused on literature as opposed to, composers or visual artists, painters, and so on?
Yeah, that's a question that we should have, addressed right from the beginning, because it's not just that literature has this grand ambition. It's that the culture was convinced that it was basically only literature that could do this. And partly this was the influence, again, of German Romanticism, which put the poet front and center and the language front and center.
Yeah.
Partly it was the reality of Russia in the day, the reality of the autocratic Tsarist regime, the censorship. So if you wish to make any political change, whether evolutionary or revolutionary, your avenue for public expression were very limited. You couldn't become a politician and run for office and make speeches, because basically that didn't exist. And even journalism, it was very difficult to write things that had any sort of political coloration. So what you would do is write a novel or a story or a poem and have the readers read carefully between the lines, because you can't write the word revolution or change or anything like this, or down with serfdom, but you can vaguely point in that direction and the critics will help the readers interpret what the writers were really saying. So one of these major critics, another very famous critic, follower of Bielinski, was Nikolai Chernyshevsky, and I'll just do one quote from him, which shows this whole situation. And he says, in countries where intellectual and social life is highly developed, there is to say a division of labor among the various branches of intellectual activity, of which only one is known to us, literature. And the latter, he concludes, quote, plays a more significant role in our intellectual advancement than French, German, and English literature do in the advancement of their own nations, and it bears heavier responsibilities than does any other literature. And just to note there, when he says things like intellectual activity and advancement, he really means progressive politics. But, you know, he can't write that again. But his readers will understand what he's talking about. So it's only literature that can do this. If you're in Germany, you can express your national identity through music and painting and everything else. But we've just got literature, and that's why it's up there on the pedestal.
Does he mean because the government is more oppressive, or because there's more social change that needs to happen, and in order to change minds, you need something like literature that can kind of insinuate itself into the discussion in a way that maybe painting and music can't?
Yeah, and a number of reasons. I've already, you know, talked about the influence of the censorship and the sort of privileging of expressions in the national language because of Romanticism. Of course, music was very important for Romanticism as well. And by the way, by the end of the 19th century in Russia, when you get the whole modernist era coming on, you get much more focus on expression, national identity, I think, in music, in the visual arts, in the sort of combined artwork of all of them together. But you do also see allusions towards finding this elusive redemptive function of literature beyond the written word. In writers like Gogol and Dostoevsky, some of their key scenes where the character's having an epiphany, it's really much more visual. They might be looking at a famous painting or an icon or something like that. And in a way, that's the author saying, I've taken it as far as words can take it, despite us saying that the word is sacred and the word is what is going to save Russia. Maybe it's something beyond the word, beyond speech, that could only be expressed in painting or also in music. And by the way, that also goes back to tendency in Russian religious thought to the idea that the divine cannot be described in words. It's something beyond what you can describe. You can't say what God is. There's no adjective that is sufficient. So at some point, even though we're putting all this pressure for literature to save us, maybe the words aren't enough and we have to go some other place to find our salvation.
When you talk about a redemptive mission, do you mean that in the Christian sense of we're all sinners and we need something to save us?
You know, here, especially amongst diehard fans of Russian literature, I expect I'll get a lot of pushback on this book because, number one, there are many important writers. I think you mentioned Chekhov at sort of the end of the 19th century who really shy away from anything resembling these big ambitions that people were happier to embrace in the early part of the century. And number two, when it comes down to precise ideological formulations of what the writers want to do, of course, there's a huge variety, you know, left-wing, right-wing, secular, religious, and some of the most interesting and productive work in Russian writing in the 19th century came out of this sort of clash between different visions of where literature could take us. But fundamentally, even those who say, like critic Chernyshevsky, who is pretty much, well, I'm about to say atheist, except I know there's some recent scholars who say, no, he was a proper Christian underneath. But, you know, there was definitely a free-thinking tendency in the left-wing progressive criticism. And they, despite not leading us to any sort of a Christian or Russian Orthodox school, my main point is, of course, the thinking was fundamentally religious. It was thinking in terms of salvation in various forms and martyrdom and so on and so forth. And it didn't hurt that a lot of these left-wing critics were the products of religious upbringing themselves. You know,
right.
They were former seminary students, as was Stalin, for example, in the 20th century, which explains a lot about his thought patterns. So this underlying religious way of seeing reality, even in a secular way, even in a virulently atheistic way, it's still there and again helps us to understand what's going on.
Right. So even if it's not any particular agenda that they all share, they all have an agenda, and the agenda seems to be that human beings need to be saved in some sense. There is a kind of arc that they're on, or a part of the importance of literature is its ability to somehow redeem people in that sense.
Yeah, and of course, for us as readers, you started off by asking where my attraction to Russian literature began. It is this sense, even if they don't reach that goal, that they have this goal that is more than just to entertain you or show you a work of art, but to, hit the really big questions and, at least instill some sort of faith in you, whether it's, religious or secular, in some sort of big answer. And, they never quite get there. They fail in interesting ways. And that's actually the topic for my next book after this that I'm about halfway through. And that's sort of like beginning with this premise that in particular in the 19th century, Russian writers tended to have these grand metaphysical ambitions for literature, to the extent that they were obviously impossible because they're writing, novels. This secular post-romantic genre of a novel cannot become a work of Holy Scripture. That's just one thing that has to be said. So they can't reach this goal. So in what interesting ways do they fail? And one way you see in Pushkin and Gogol, especially in Dostoevsky, is they keep putting off the novel in which they're going to solve all of humanity's problems. Like at the end of Crime and Punishment, the axe-murdering university student has finally confessed. He's off to Siberia. We are promised that he'll have some sort of spiritual redemption. He's got the New Testament there. He's, going to read it and all of that. But then Dostoevsky's narrator comes in and says, but that is a topic for a new story, and our present story is done. So it's sort of like, I will show you the redemption of this character, which will be the model for your own personal redemption. The redemptive mission is out there, but it's just in my next book. And I he never quite gets there.
How Russian literature became not so great.
I was toying with that as a subtitle. Right now, it's the rather staid, the compensatory strategies. What strategies they use to compensate for their failure. But of course, it's not really a failure because that's the nature of literature.
Right.
It always points beyond something that it can actually show and tell us. It sort of gives us this enthusiasm. It affects us on the emotional level without laying out the plan for whatever salvation it is. It sort of shows us there's a light on the horizon.
Right. Now, we talked about how this, in the 19th century, this call for change and this desire to move things in a particular way could have been a threat to the regime and the government. Has the government also used this power of literature? Have they tried to harness it? So I'm imagining that there would be some desire to say, well, yes, this, we could use these novels as kind of propaganda, that it could help us bring Russians together, or it could help us in our efforts to appropriate other cultures or to inspire the people or motivate or moralize in some way. Is it, do you see that as well in the relationship between the government and literature?
Well, here the 19th century, which is my main focus, is a bit of an exception. Before the 19th century, and before Peter the Great in particular, in the long Middle Ages I was talking about, of course, literature was first and foremost an ideological tool for the government. Most of the content was religious, or it was praising the princely rulers. And so the main patrons of writers were the government. And then only really by the time of Pushkin in the 19th century, you had this new commercialization of literature where you could perhaps actually make a living writing literature. There was a rise of a literary journal culture and so on and so forth. And this is, of course, a major economic factor underpinning the ability of writers to take the oppositional stance in which they were pleasing the critics and their readers rather than pleasing the government because the government was no longer paying them. Although, and in the 19th century, for most of the part, the government was suspicious of writers. Often the Tsars took a, what would be surprising for us, personal interest in the fates of the writers. The very authoritarian Tsar Nicholas I and his personal relationship with Pushkin, for example, the national poet saying, "I will be your benefactor," which actually meant I will be your personal censor, which was not a good thing for the career of this rebellious romantic poet. But basically, in the 19th century, they weren't taking these novels and these poems and saying, let's use them to enhance official national identity, you know, for the most part. And when things were really starting to become canonized, when they were first beginning to put up statues, you know, around the 1880s, still it was seen as not as suspicious activity on the part of the government. They wanted to keep an eye on what was happening. Mind you, in the 20th century, when the Soviets came along, they all understood very well the ideological potential of literature, and they took the 19th century classics, reading them in their own way, and really institutionalized that, made everybody read it in rather highly conservative educational program that continues for the most part down to the present day. So all the Russian school children still read these 19th century classics, still know their Pushkin and their Tolstoy. Dostoevsky wasn't really so much of a acceptable figure under Stalin, but for the most part, the 19th century was seen as something that could be used as a propaganda tool. And at the same time, of course, there was a genuine dissident counterculture, alternative literature scene that was coming up in the Soviet era with people like Solzhenitsyn, whom I mentioned. And after 1991, after the Soviet era, you know, too early to tell what the real relationship of the powers that be in literature are, except, of course, that a lot of people have been worried that classical literature has lost its dominance once and for all with the opening of the floodgates to Western culture and mass media and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you referred in your book to a post-1991 crisis of faith in writing centrality. And is that, I guess that's from what you just said, it sounds like that's worried about television and film and things that might be more influential now, the internet and social media and so on, and just a general feeling that literature can no longer play the role in terms of national identity that it once did?
Yeah, on the purely practical level, there's that. You know, when it was possible to publish what you wanted under the Perestroika and Glasnost and Gorbachev's time, and then in the 1990s, of course, people were all interested in reading Agatha Christie in translation and so on and so forth, and romance novels and whatever mass market stuff from the West, not to speak of competition from television and eventually the internet. So there was a sense of crisis, and also, of course, a role was played by the fact that literature had this great mission, and had it succeeded whatsoever, you know, whether it was in creating a just society along the Soviet aspirations or in opposing that, had it measured up to its potential in any way. But the one thing that has to be said is that, at least from the official point of view, 19th century classics and selected 20th century classics are still front and center of the educational curriculum and are still something that the Putin regime pays direct attention to. And I do cite some passages from recent speeches by Putin talking about the great Russian literature along with Russian language as ideological tools for enhancing the geopolitical situation of Russia. So certainly it's officially supported very much. And this is part of the reason why we see such a backlash, the whole cancel Russian culture, in particular cancel Russian literature thing that you will see in the context of the Russia-Ukraine war, in which, quite rightly, a lot of people opposing the Russian invasion will point out that there were a lot of 19th century classics like the later Dostoevsky, for example, when he grew quite conservative in his later years, or Pushkin in some ways, who were big Russian patriots, Russian imperialists. If Dostoevsky were alive today, I suppose he would support the war. You know, maybe Solzhenitsyn, the later Solzhenitsyn, would support the war as well. And all of this, of course, it makes people like me very nervous. You know, when I just have a book coming out with the title it has about, you know, what am I doing and am I supporting this in any way by somehow upholding this canon with all of the ideological attachments that it has. So it's a tricky business. Russian culture will not be canceled. We don't really have that power. We flatter ourselves to think that it can be done, but everything that Russian literary scholars do nowadays has to be thought of in terms of how it's being used as a weapon.
Mm. Right. And so instead of a look at the title and a takeaway of, Russian literature is great, so deal with it. We all can admire it. It's more like, how did this happen that we came to believe Russian literature is great? How did that come about, and what has that meant, and what does it still mean today?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I didn't want to give a big fat subtitle to explain it all, but of course there is a certain ironic distance in the adjective great. I'm not saying it's not great.
Mm. Right.
By whatever objective measure you want to apply. I enjoy reading these masterpieces. What has greatness meant in this literary context? And, you know, I do in the conclusion go a bit beyond that and talk about what this category has meant for Russian culture in particular. And you'll see a lot of the ideological output focusing on the idea that Russia can only be great or nothing. And by the way, you can't have any sort of a make Russia great again scenario. That slogan is not going to work, because Russia can only have ever been great, because its very existence depends on its greatness. It's sort of like, this is a country that God made to be great, and if we stop being great, we will disappear. And if you have to tell us, you know, to stop our borders expanding at any point, it is already a threat to our existence. A lot of, you know, explanation is required to sort of get close to understanding that sort of attitude, but this belief in the concept of greatness is important. And by the way, you know, it is part of Russian exceptionalism, but as I also note in a footnote in the book, it's another thing that came from the West. Some people associate the idea of this necessary Russian greatness with Peter the Great, the Tsar, though the best recent link I can see is Charles de Gaulle from France, who wrote in his memoirs, you know, one cannot conceive of France without the greatness of France.
Hmm. Right. Okay. Well, let's leave things there. Rolf Hellebust, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
And finally today, it's not hard to choose my last book that would involve a Russian author. They are well represented among people of whom I've asked this question. We've shared many of them with you already. Anna Karenina in particular is a big favorite, but also, let's see, the Brothers Karamazov has appeared a few times. Let's instead go with one that's a little off the beaten path. This is Valeria Sobol was the guest. After she and I discussed the Russian Gothic, I asked her this special question. Okay, we're joined now by Professor Valeria Sobol, author of the book Haunted Empire, Gothic and the Russian Imperial Uncanny. Valeria, this question comes from a listener who writes, "What do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written."
Whew, that's a morbid question, I would say. Interesting. I hope it's, as I said, right, the book that I'll read, not the last book that I'll write.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So an easy answer would be The Death of Ivan Ilyich by Tolstoy, but I think it's too dark.
Yeah.
It's too dark.
Yeah. Okay.
It has light at the end. But it's maybe too dark, although it could be helpful to go.
Yeah.
To go like he did. But I think deep inside, I would have rather read something fun and uplifting. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe one of my favorites from my, you know, adolescent years, like Ilfa Petrov's satirical novel, The 12 Chairs, about a con man tricking the Soviet system in the 1920s. Not just the Soviet system, but various citizens. It's really funny, kind of strange novel. So I think I'm torn. I think maybe the funny one. Yeah. Mm. I wanna go with laughter.
Okay. And that was, I'm not familiar with that book. You said it was by Petrov?
It's co-authored by two friends, both pen names, Ilya Ilf and Evgeny Petrov. And they wrote kind of two novels around the same character, the con man Ostap Bender, who kind of goes around late 1920s Russia and tries to actually become a rich man. In the first book, The 12 Chairs, he finds out that there are some diamonds from the pre-revolutionary times from a wealthy family sewn in a chair, but the chair is one of the 12 chairs of a set. And now those chairs have been sold out across the Soviet Union, and he is kind of chasing them, trying to find that one chair with gems, and unsuccessfully. But it's full of adventures and just funny satire. It was actually amazing that it was published in the Soviet Union, but things were a little calmer, less restrictive at the time. And it's like my family is basically an internal language, like frame of reference. We use jokes and quotes from this novel as a kind of our little code. And it's quite popular in general among the, you know, Russian-speaking families from the region. So I think that would be the one.
That sounds like a good choice. 12 Chairs. Valeria Sobel, thank you so much for joining me on The History of Literature.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. So my thanks to Valeria Sobel for that interesting and thoughtful choice, and to Rolf Hellebust for that wonderful discussion. You can find their books at bookstores near you. We will learn how to talk. We will be back soon with maybe a look at George Simenon, author of the Magre novels. That's been one I've been hoping to do for a long time. I see a little window. This might be my chance. We also have Margaret Fuller coming up soon, and many other good episodes in the works. So please subscribe and follow. Make sure you don't miss them. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.